James loved nothing more than a chance to be portrayed as the hero, as the person that survived, as the protagonist. He really knew how to make political capital of this sort of thing. He did it with the gunpowder plot. All of a sudden, he's presented as narrow escape. Thank God, look, I've survived. I'm a hero. He did it with the Gowrie conspiracy in Scotland. Where, look, I've escaped an assassination attempt. Aren't I amazing? Hasn't God clearly chosen me? He did it with the witches in 1590 to 91. Look, there was this evil witchcraft attempt, treasonous attempt on me. I foiled it. I escaped. Aren't I great?
Hello and welcome to the pod. This week's guest is Stephen Verapin, who is the author of a new book on James I, who was the first of the Stuart dynasty to rule England, but of course was also King of Scotland. There's a new drama that has made waves about him, Mary and George, but in this chat we get to the bottom of who he was and his rule, both of Scotland and England. The man that emerges is complex and intelligent, so I do hope you enjoy our discussion. Coming up on the pod, Artemis Cooper joins me to talk Patrick Leigh Fermor, the man who fought the Germans behind enemy lines in Crete and was one of the great travel writers. I've got an episode on Checkpoint Charlie and then Britain's relationship with Iran, so please do subscribe, share and like if you can. Links to all we discuss are in the show notes, but until then I'm going to hand you over to me, Stephen and James the First. Stephen, great to have you back on the pod. It's been a while, but you've been on a number of times. But thank you for coming back on.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
And then so to last, I think last time you were on, we did depictions of Elizabeth the First
Yes, we did.
on screen. Yeah, so I'll link that into the show notes for listeners if they haven't got to that. But today we're discussing the subject of your first non-fiction book. No, that's not true.
It's not, it was my first with Berlin. It was the first
Yes,
non-fiction with Berlin.
I just realized. Yes, you wrote Elizabeth and Leicester as well, wasn't it?
Elizabeth and Essex,
Essex.
yes.
Oh
So
God.
I wish I'd written Elizabeth and Leicester. That was a longer relationship.
Yeah. So this is James the First, or I should say James the Sixth as well.
It's a mouthful, isn't it? James the Sixth and First.
Yes. And so he's an interesting character. He's a monarch. I remember you mentioning this before, maybe a monarch that is often we skip over. We have Elizabeth, obviously gets a lot of attention. Then we skip over and go to Charles the First, who lost his head, and we do miss out on quite a lengthy reign, and a very interesting character act actually when you dig into it and look through your book.
I think so, yes. Why do we ignore him, or why does he get brushed over? And I think it is you have this big iconic figure in Elizabeth I, as we spoke about all the depictions of her. I had to boil it down to 10. There were far more than 10 depictions of Elizabeth on screen. And then with Charles, you get the big tragedy, the decapitation, the civil wars, all of this high drama. And James then seems to almost get lost in the space in between. There's a, I suppose, a perception that, well, he couldn't have been that interesting. And I think, well, actually, that's kind of looking at it the wrong way because he must have been successful to have maintained this peace, this stability for this period. Because, I mean, it could have gone so differently. A foreign king coming to the throne, it actually worked out a fairly stable, settled way.
There are many dramatic things, well, early on in his life. I mean, he becomes King of Scotland at the age of one, which
Yes, yeah. Scotland
is
had a habit of crowning children, didn't it? Although what was unusual there was that his mother was still alive. It wasn't a case of, as Mary Queen of Scots had come to the throne at 6 days old, that was because her father had died. James came to the throne at a year old because his mother had been deposed. So it was even more turbulent, I guess.
I mean, they were a different religion. What was the relationship between? I mean, they didn't have a relationship, did they, Mary and James?
They didn't know there were attempts at a kind of long distance relationship by letter. Now, that was unusual. We know from various royals of the period that it was almost kind of normal. It's become like a cliche to say, oh, yeah, royal children were always brought up away from their parents. They were always fostered out into noble households and things. And yes, that's true, but it wasn't a normal thing in James's case, because not only was he separated from his mother, he was actively taught by the Protestant elite, who kind of won the coup and gained control, to hate her and to fear her and to despise her. All of this sort of horrible stuff that was poured into James's mind as a child.
What effect did that have? Because, I mean, look, being apart from your mother, even if it was, you know, as you've just mentioned, it wasn't massively unusual. I mean, it's still...
Yes, you would think even if you were apart from your parent as a royal child, generally you were taught to respect them and to almost hold them in awe. I mean, this was a biblical commandment, you know, you should obey your mother and father and all that sort of stuff. James was taught the opposite by the people that surrounded him. He was taught your mother was an evil woman, she murdered your father, you should hate and fear her. And I think the effect of it actually was the opposite, probably, of what quite a few people wanted. He ended up fairly fascinated by his mother. She was this remote, interesting figure, and he became really obsessed with the idea of family in general. As we see in his later relationships, he was always trying to build a family.
Oh, that's quite, you know...
Sad, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, it is. It is. And his father, his father was this quite kind of... You discussed his father on a previous episode. He was a bit of a lunatic, actually, wasn't he?
Yeah, I feel a bit sorry for Darnley. I probably am the only person that does. The reason that I feel a kind of sympathy for him is his age. It's
yeah,
really
he was
just
young,
his
wasn't
age.
He? Yeah.
He was really young. He was 20, 21 when he was assassinated. And I mean, it was kind of, he was thrown in at the deep end of Scottish politics and of English politics, really, and didn't have the brains or the maturity to deal with it. And that's why I'm not saying he was a good person, or he certainly did some very bad things, but I think it's possible to have a kind of sympathy for him.
And so James's claim to the throne, though, his succeeding Elizabeth, who of course had no children, and therefore is, I think, a cousin once removed from...
Yes, so Henry VIII's sister, Margaret, had married James IV of Scotland, and the Stuart line then obviously passed with a bit of Tudor blood from Margaret downwards. But Henry VIII was an irritant to me, just to me personally, to me particularly, because...
You've described him as a psychopath, I think, before.
Yes, I will stick to that, I will stand by that.
But I'm up for
why
that, yeah.
Why he's irritating is, when it comes to the succession, he meddled with it in various ways, with parliamentary acts. He excluded the Stuarts when he left his succession acts. So it doesn't become a kind of easy thing to follow. It becomes a complicated thing to follow. And it must have really irritated first Mary, Queen of Scots, and then James, because hierarchically, there should have been no question mark over their claim to the English throne. But because of what Henry had done in his lifetime of not barring them, in terms of putting that explicitly, but excluding them, not including them in a line of succession, and providing an alternative non-lineal line of descent, it passed over the Stuarts and went to the heirs of his other sister, Mary. So it was needlessly complicated. It raised a lot of questions. It raised a lot of legal issues as well in Mary's reign, Mary Queen of Scots' reign, and obviously in Elizabeth's reign as well. Can these Scottish people actually inherit the throne of England? It's not clear. Is the throne of England like a piece of English property which can't be inherited by aliens? It's not clear. So it made a lot of lawyers rich, I suppose.
Yes,
as legal questions often do.
Yes, that's something that has always been the case and always will be the case, I suppose. But what was the view of Scotland down in England around about the time of Elizabeth, when she's, because she never goes for James becoming her successor, does she?
She never said yes.
Yes.
She never said anything that could be taken as sort of concrete endorsement of any particular claim. She liked to
And
play
there were
off.
two sovereign states as well. Should you know, just
Yes,
for
yeah.
those who are probably not, maybe not familiar, but it wasn't as if there were any kind of union. They were separate countries.
Yep, yeah, independent monarchies, so two independent nations. And the view of it's really interesting, actually, if you look at the 1590s, if you look at the dramas and things that were being written, it seems that for a long time, no one thought about Scotland, I think, in England, or particularly in the southeast in London. I don't think there was a huge interest in England. When it became a possibility that we're going to get a Scottish king coming down, you start to see this spike in interest, spike in dramas being written by playwrights and things representing Scotland as if they're trying to get a feel for what might happen, what this might be like.
So what are the circumstances? You know, you've just said that Elizabeth never categorically stated that James would be her successor.
This drove
But
him nuts. He could not shut up about the succession. He could not stop bombarding her with letters, bombarding her with demands that she recognize him, even when it was counterproductive to do so, because it just pissed her off, really. She kept getting asked about it. What he did, first of all, was try and set up contacts at the English court, which would kind of build a party or a faction in his favour. He bet on the wrong horse, first of all, though, with Essex, Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, who, as we know, tried to launch a coup against Elizabeth and failed and lost his head. But James, I mean, that could have been disastrous if it all come out that James had been communicating with this guy.
so
James
that
was
was
able.
never revealed, that
It was never revealed.
he got away
Essex,
with that.
Essex did James a solid at the end before he was captured. He threw the letters in the fire. So it was,
Wow.
I suspect Elizabeth probably knew or suspected, but she never made a big issue of it. What he did then was much more intelligent, I think. He got in good with Elizabeth's chief secretary, Robert Cecil. He was really the kind of chief bureaucrat. He, if anyone, would be able to manage the succession in James's favour. So he and James really became intimates, I suppose, from a distance, remote intimates. And Cecil assured him when she dies. I mean, remember, this could have happened any day in the late 1590s and early 1600s. She could have died at any moment. Cecil was doing the groundwork to prepare for James's succession.
But if Elizabeth, as you say, was she was a very smart woman, you know, she knew the succession was up for grabs. What was her solution?
God would sort it out, I think, was Elizabeth's solution. I suspect she knew Cecil was working with James, and there are various stories of Cecil attending on her and a man turning up, a postman, an early modern postman, someone turning up with letters from James, and Cecil suddenly panicking because she reaches for them and he has to take them, sort of get them off her before she can see them. And she knew, I think, she knew what he was up to, but she turned a blind eye to it and she would give no sort of firm pronouncement. So I think genuinely Elizabeth's view was God, it's for God to sort out the succession. I think that's how she viewed it.
Fair enough, I
And I
suppose.
know that sounds kind of glib to say, but religion was important to these people. Faith was. If she believed, then I don't just mean she, in a flippant way, she thought God would sort it out. I mean, she really thought, God exists. God will sort this out.
Yes, that's important to say, actually. And James, presumably, though, a natural question might be why would he want the throne of England? But really, he viewed it was his, the crown.
Yes, I think there are two things there. One of them is if you were an early modern monarch, it was almost a kind of affront to your honour if you did not seek your rights, if you were not publicly recognised. So when he married Anne of Denmark, they were both united in this. It's for the Stuart family honour. We are owed this. And that was not unusual. The other reason is James had a really rosy view of England. He almost seemed to ignore the troubles that the various Tudor monarchs had faced, and he had this perception of England that it was rich. So he thought, I'll be rich when I get it. It turned out that was wrong because it was a lot of debt that he was going to make worse. He also really liked the idea of the English church, of which the English monarch was head, he struggled long and hard in Scotland to be recognised as head of the Scottish Kirk. The Presbyterians were obviously much more in favour of rule by presbyteries. They wanted Kirk elders and things to manage the church. They didn't think that a secular monarch had any right to claim supreme spiritual authority. Whereas James could look south and he saw Elizabeth as supreme governor of the English church. He saw a flock of loyal bishops and he thought, God, that's what I want and that's what I deserve.
Now, I've taken quite a kind of English view there by asking about the English throne. But of course, you know, he's King of Scotland. And so what about the Scottish subjects? What was the view in Scotland that, you know, he physically moves south to London? Were they happy with the arrangement of the unification of the crown?
No, I think no is the answer. There was, James wanted more than the unification of the crowns. He wanted full political union, but not just for its own sake. Again, because he had this idealised view of England, he wanted Scotland to be anglicised. That's really his big political goal, which he never achieved because the Scots didn't want it and the English didn't want it. So he pressed on in the first decade or so of his English reign, trying to almost force at first or cajole and press forward with this idea of a union of the two countries into one. And he was fighting a losing battle.
Within a few years of him acceding to the throne, he has to deal with a massive assassination attempt.
Yes. Oh, he loved it. He loved it. James, one of the things James absolutely loved was narrow escapes from death. He tried this multiple times. I'm not saying the gunpowder plot wasn't real. It was very real. But James loved nothing more than a chance to be portrayed as the hero, as the person that survived, as the protagonist. He really knew how to make political capital of this sort of thing. He did it with the gunpowder plot. All of a sudden, he's presented as narrow escape. Thank God, look, I've survived. I'm a hero. He did it with the Gowrie conspiracy in Scotland. Where, look, I've escaped an assassination attempt. Aren't I amazing? Hasn't God clearly chosen me? He did it with the witches in 1590 to 91. Look, there was this evil witchcraft attempt, treasonous attempt on me. I foiled it. I escaped. Aren't I great?
Oh, so let's hear about that, the witches then, because Leander de Lisle was on. We did a quick run through of the Stuarts, and she mentioned the fact that James was rather upset that people didn't remember the Gowrie plot. They banged on about the gunpowder plot, but the Gowrie plot got overlooked. So
yes,
I think
no one
this
remembers. Remember the 5th of August. It doesn't
yeah,
roll off
exactly.
The tongue.
Exactly. But the witches, and this is, you know, prescient, given that you've just, I think you've told me you've just finished a book on witches. So what is James doing with witches in Scotland in the 1590s?
In the 1590s, a lot. In the 1580s, not very much. So something happened. Something really sparked an intense interest in the occult and the supernatural. And that, I mean, we know what it was. It's when he married Anna of Denmark, he sailed over to Norway, actually, and then on to Denmark to retrieve her because strange storms had sprung up in the North Sea that prevented her from making it over to Scotland. In Denmark, this was blamed on witchcraft. And James got to hear about this. And what he seems to have done is decided the Danish witches who were rounded up and tortured and all the horrible things, they couldn't have been working alone. So he started to look for Scottish witches. And when the funny thing, it's not funny, the odd thing about these kinds of trials is when authorities start looking for something, they invariably find it. And so James, as the authorities had done in Denmark, I mean, they didn't just round up randoms. They had suspected witches on other charges and they tortured them until they admitted that, oh yes, we also raised the storms and here are the names of the other people that were involved. Same thing happened in Scotland almost immediately when James became interested in this. A servant girl, Gaelis Duncan, had been taken up by her master. And all of a sudden, she started admitting it wasn't just sort of independent witchcraft she'd been up to. It was a big plot involving lots of names. And
And
all of
was
a
this the,
sudden,
was she just asked an innocent question and she immediately volunteered the information, or was she put through a rather strenuous questioning session? Was she
I
taught?
suspect she was put through a very, very strenuous questioning session. Now, it becomes tricky to know exactly what happened in that. That became the first really big witch hunt in Scotland. It wouldn't be the last, but it became the first one. And we have various sources on it. We have some of the trial records. They don't tell us what went on in between these people confessing. So they might have someone admitting to this, admitting to that, but what went on before those words came out of their mouth, and we can suspect. The other source is the News from Scotland, which was a pamphlet that was sent south, published in London, and it gave a kind of providential view of things. This was James's view of things. It was there was a treasonable conspiracy at work, basically. We now I guess a terrorist plot, but using witchcraft as the means. And James, being a hero, foiled it, and being chosen by God, was specially protected, and all of this sort of stuff. Now, I don't think he was acting cynically. He believed this, and it's very easy to look back and think, God, what a gullible idiot. It was all nonsense. No such thing as devilish witchcraft. But James really fancied himself, with good reason, as a kind of modern intellectual, someone that had done the reading. He had done his homework. And what the reading and the homework at that time in Europe were really pushing was witchcraft is real. It manifests in very particular ways. It involves the pact with the devil, which hadn't always been a kind of accepted thing. So James was at the forefront of modern intellectual thinking on witchcraft. It wasn't that he was looking backwards and being really sort of medieval in his views. It was the opposite. He was being the Renaissance man. This stuff exists. He's found it. He's uncovered it.
It's almost like a qualification as well. It helps down south when you, I guess, when you head south to become monarch.
Yes, he was the prime enemy of Satan in Scotland.
Yeah.
And there is a big question why, and lots of books will tell you James grew more skeptical when he went to England. He sort of repented his earlier gullibility. Not at all. He had always been a skeptic of false witchcraft, of sort of frivolous witchcraft. He'd always, since he started learning about it, been a believer in genuine demonic witchcraft, and he maintained that. So when we see him stopping trials in England and sort of exposing frauds in England, he's not doing that because he's suddenly become skeptical. He's doing that because he was always very keen to sort of distinguish real witchcraft, the real demonic stuff, which he thought, because he had this jaundiced view of Scotland, was everywhere in Scotland, from false, illegitimate attempts at witchcraft, which he I suppose wanted to expose. I suppose it's like the modern day Catholic Church, I think, and its view of exorcisms. As far as I'm getting, I was raised Catholic, but I'm not an expert in Catholicism or anything. But from what I understand, the Catholic Church now still has exorcism as a kind of real phenomenon. It accepts it as a real phenomenon. Does, however, try and investigate cases to sort of distinguish real possession cases from false ones. So that's exactly what James was doing. It doesn't mean that the Catholic Church doesn't really believe in exorcism if it sort of denies some of them. It doesn't mean that James stopped ever believing in witchcraft just because he exposed false cases.
Interesting. That's a side of him I had absolutely no idea about. It's again, something that has been raised so many times by guests is this idea religion was such a central part of life, where we now live in a world where it just isn't for the
And it
majority.
becomes difficult. It becomes very easy then to be cynical. I think I found myself doing it. You think you look back, you think, oh, they must have known that wasn't real. They must have sort of seen the flaws in logic there. But what we see as flaws in logic are coming just from a different worldview. I mean, James wrote after the North Berwick witch case, the 1590 to 91 one was called. He wrote his book Demonology. in which he really set out his stall for what is real, what is not real, what can be accepted as evidence, what can't be accepted as evidence. So he made his feelings clear. And then he drove another witch hunt in 1597 to purge Scotland of these witches. So I think it was I really do think he had such a suspicious view of Scotland based on his youth and his childhood and the kidnapping attempts, the assassination attempts, these things, that he really believed that Scotland was the devil's playground. Scotland found rich.
Like a sort of failed state in a way.
Exactly. Although I think he would deny the failed part because he was very much...
He had fixed it, right.
He was fixing it. So I think he could very easily believe that Satan found lots of slaves, as he called them. He called witches the devil's slaves. The devil found a lot of them in Scotland. He found it more difficult, I think, to reconcile England being... I guess, prone to lots of witchcraft cases. So he was quite willing to expose the fakes there.
It's interesting that despite the sort of tumultuous period of the Reformation and Edward VI, Mary, and then Elizabeth, you know, the plots that were going on as well, England, he views as a more stable country. I don't know. I'm saying these things that I'm probably wrong, but...
No, I think you're right. And it's something that I've just always struggled with because it is very clear to me that he did view England as far more settled, far more stable. But why? I mean,
yes.
He must have known. I think he really almost looked up to Elizabeth. I mean, he resented Elizabeth a great deal, but I think he did have this perception that she had kind of done it. She had settled England. He wanted to settle Scotland, and then he wanted to almost gain that settled England as well.
Well, he was probably right. I mean, you know, this podcast is a huge fan of Elizabeth. She is on our logo, our new logo.
Oh, good. Well, I like Elizabeth.
Yes.
A lot of time for her.
So you're saying he resented her, but, you know, I'm using very general terms, so hope the listeners can forgive me. But generally speaking, Elizabeth is hugely admired now. You know, was that the case for the time?
In England, I think it's such a difficult question to answer. I mean, there are lots of studies that kind of question the mythos. What we can't deny is that the myth was effective. I mean, you see the myth of Elizabeth within years of her death taking on totemic proportions. People are looking back and just waxing nostalgic about what a great time it was when Elizabeth was alive and we were at war with Spain, all of this sort of stuff. So the myth was massively effective. There were lots of people in Elizabeth's reign who couldn't stand her and who were reported or arrested or all kinds of things, got into trouble for saying things negatively about her. So she obviously, but no leader is universally popular ever, but I think she had kind of institutions which she managed to manage extremely effectively. So she managed to, despite being a woman, and I think that's worth commenting on, she managed to position herself as head of the church, supreme governor of the church. She managed to kind of push down this rising Puritan sense that was popping up. It kept popping up under James, certainly kept popping up under Charles. She managed that. She managed parliaments effectively. Yes, she would clap people in the Tower of London if they spoke about her marriage or anything, but she managed to sort of govern all of these institutions, which others would have found difficult, I think.
Rather like her namesake, Elizabeth II, who during her reign came under quite a lot of fire, particularly, you know, around the mid-90s. And now when you hear commentators talking about Elizabeth II, there's a lot of reverence and you don't really hear...
Certain figures are almost placed beyond criticism, which is, I think it's actually kind of dangerous to do that with people, to put them beyond any sort of criticism. But yet you do see it. The Tudors tried to legally enforce it. They tried to put themselves beyond criticism by passing laws, felony statutes and things that would get your hands chopped off if you did criticise them. And what's interesting is that people still did it. We know that there are reports of people who spread rumours about Elizabeth having illegitimate children, who called Elizabeth all kinds of unpleasant names and things. So people were criticising. But again, James, I think, he wouldn't have known that necessarily. He wouldn't have sort of known that someone in, I don't know, in Leicester was arrested for spreading slanderous words about the Queen. He would have viewed things as almost an institutional sort of structure. She has that under her. I don't have that under me. So she has the English church under her. I don't have the English church under me. She can arrest people who would preach against her. I have to just stand here and listen to them badmouth me from the pulpit. So I think he just really admired England's, I don't even know if we can call it stability. It did achieve stability, but England's kind of a legal system, its internal structure and everything like that, whereas he thought Scotland was riddled with rebellious people and troublesome people. He can be forgiven for this because there were a lot of people trying to kill him or trying to start uprisings against him and things like that.
Well, yeah, indeed, as you know, with the Gowrie plot. So
yeah.
Was the transition smooth when he acceded to the throne? I mean, we know about the Gunpowder Plot, but that's 2 years later.
Yeah, yeah. Incredibly smooth. I mean, there were a couple of very minor, still kind of baffling mini plots, the main plot and the by plot, which Walter Raleigh got sort of caught up in and punished for. But he rode into England, really, and then Anna and the children rode in behind him later on to this wave of acclamation that was probably bigger than anything Elizabeth had ever seen in terms of just public celebration. Because obviously coming down from Scotland, they passed through places that Elizabeth had never been, that Elizabeth had never seen. So he passed through York, for example. James, I think, at first really revelled in this. This is what he had imagined, just this absolute deference. The one thing James wanted, and he never really got it in Scotland, was deference. He wanted people to bow and scrape and to acknowledge him as God's anointed, because he had this, not just a view of himself, but a view of monarchy as something that was appointed by God. Now, that I think they all did, monarchs at that time, but in Scotland it was not, to James's view, treated, I suppose, as respectfully as he would have liked. He was treated like a man in Scotland. He wanted to be treated like a god.
Okay, so there's nothing less godlike than a massive assassination attempt.
But he made it work. Again, he made it work. He shaped the narrative around that. It's, look, but God protected me. It was almost written up as being a last-minute reprieve. God had intervened directly and saved him.
But he didn't then go DEFCON 1 on all Catholics in England, though, did
no,
he?
No, no. And that, I think, is, again,
it's to his credit.
Yeah, it's to his credit, and I think explicable in terms of what his goals were. When he was King of England, even in those early years, he wanted unification of Scotland and England. And I think starting any kind of big religious war would have just squashed that immediately. He also wanted the various European Protestant sects to kind of unite together, to come together, to hold conferences, to reach some sort of peaceful accord as a prelude to making an accord with the Roman Catholic Church. So he had this really admirable goal, I think, of pan-European religious peace. And I think taking revenge on all Catholics for the action of a minority of extremists would have really just ruined his bigger plans.
Yeah, he would have seen the wars of religion in France,
absolutely,
wouldn't he? Mm. Yeah. So he would have been delighted with the Act of Union in 1707. Obviously he was dead.
Yes.
But that would have pleased him.
It would to an extent, but I think from James's perspective, maybe not as much as people think. So again, the history books often say the union James sought was achieved, you know, hundreds so years after his death. Not quite, because James wanted more. James wanted the English common law to be, he said that was the most perfect type of law. He wanted that to sweep north. He wanted Scotland's church, the Kirk, to almost be kind of swept up with the English church.
Sorry to interrupt you. You'd have the English legal system in Scotland. So for listeners who aren't familiar, there's a different legal system up in Scotland. And then you would have the Church of England would become what? The Church of Britain?
The Church of Scotland, instead of the Church of Scotland being what it is. So yes, the 1707 Act of Union had certain matters that weren't integrated. So Scotland kept Scots law. Scotland kept the Scottish Kirk, its own religious system and all of that sort of stuff. I think it's why I'm sure when, well, it was Elizabeth II, but then Charles now, when they go to, or come to, I should say, to Scotland, and they go to church, they go as members, not as the head. Whereas in England, when they go to church, they are the head. That's strange, isn't it? But that's one of the things that just didn't change with that union. Scotland kept some things independent, which James wouldn't have wanted. And those were the things that James wanted, really, to be anglicised, religion particularly.
That's so interesting. So how is James viewed? Okay, so those who take an interest in history, and they may well do even more after the TV show Mary and George that's on at the moment, and we'll talk about that. But how is James viewed today? Because that, you know, in Scotland, SNPs in government, desiring of abandoning the Act of Union. How is James viewed?
Just amongst the general public, I don't think James is viewed much at all, which is a shame because he's an interesting figure, an interesting character as well. But I think I'm right in saying that schools which obviously teach history have him as an option, I think, as a topic almost, in the way that English schools, I guess, might have the Tudors, but they don't all use that option. So a lot of kids will come away from school never having necessarily heard of King James. So most people probably, if they know him at all, they know him for witches, relationship with witches or antagonism towards witches, or they possibly know him for, I can't even say union because obviously that came later, maybe the union of the crowns, but generally in terms of personality, actions, people will know Mary Queen of Scots. In Scotland, everyone, I think, vaguely knows who Mary Queen of Scots was. James, not so much. And I think that's probably the same in England. I don't know. He's not seen on screen up until this new show. He's not particularly well known amongst just people that like historical dramas.
Yeah, well, okay, let's talk about his depiction on screen at the moment. He's a really good actor, Tony Curran, actually, who I know from the 90s from the TV show This Life.
I don't know it.
Really? Oh, God, it was massive in the 90s. Anyway, Tony Curran.
I was a babe in arms, Ollie.
Yeah, I'm showing my age. So he plays he's not the young, I mean, what? James was 35 when he became King of England?
He was 36 and then 36. Turned 37 in the June.
So Mary and George, this is really about the Duke of Buckingham's relationship with James. So this is James's sex life is
shown in graphic detail.
Four episodes, right.
Yes.
Okay, so James, it's fair to, he had many children, but he also had, I mean, the Duke of Buckingham is probably the most famous lover that he had, male lover he had, isn't he?
Yes, we never really mentioned it at all. We mentioned Anna. James was bisexual, but I think historically he has been seen as, you know, that would be brushed over, or more recently he's just been seen as being homosexual, but he was very definitely bisexual. How do we know that? Well, when he was married to Anna in Scotland, there were lots of children. I mean, children year on year, but there were no reports of male lovers. He had them before her. He married her and seemed to be getting satisfaction, I suppose, with his wife. And then when he came to England, that's when you start to see the rise of male lovers. Now, one of the things the show does, I'm sure some people will have seen it, that I think is a bit of a problem, and it's enjoyable. I'm enjoying watching it, but it kind of makes him out to have no other interest in life than sex. There's just so much.
Reading a book does not make for good TV.
Yeah. it can also suggest that at his core, it was I mean, really, just orgies happening, just naked people hanging around having sex with each other everywhere, in corridors, base everywhere. But what's interesting is that when he took on his more famous male lovers, Somerset, Robert Carr, who he made the Earl of Somerset, and then Villiers, who eventually became the Duke of Buckingham, he seems to be, I guess, fairly faithful to these lovers. I don't think it's a coincidence that when he fell in love with Robert Carr, that's when the children stopped with Anna. Her last child was 1606, I believe. Then he fell in love with Robert Carr the next year. No more children. So he'd obviously transferred his affections or his family.
Yeah, as you say, that implies a an affection rather than he was going around doing everything to everyone.
Yeah, I know, but I have to say, in that show, everyone's doing everyone. No one is faithful to anyone, from what I've seen. But I suppose it's like if we had a drama series about Henry VIII, when he falls in love with Anne Boleyn, we are reasonably sure that, it's in a drama he's going to stick with Anne Boleyn. We know he's not then suddenly having orgies in the palace. So I thought that was kind of unusual. James, when he fell in love with someone, seemed to stay fairly faithful to that person.
I mentioned just to get probably a rise out of Leander, and she didn't give me much time, as is her style, that James laid the groundwork for the English Civil War, which is very unfair because the Civil War took place many years. What is it, 50, 16 years after his death?
So he died in 1525. And
1625.
1525,
16, yeah.
1625, sorry,
Yeah, and it's
1625.
1640. Yeah,
I
one.
was only 100 years out. No, that is a big question because it is possible, and I know historians for years and years and years, centuries probably, have tried to find the roots of the Civil War. I mean, if we are going to say it was James and his fraught relationship with Parliament, then you can't stop there then. No, it was Elizabeth and her fraught relationship with Parliament that
Well,
James
every
inherited.
monarch, yeah,
Or
falls out with with Parliament.
Or it was, in fact, no, it was Henry VIII who emboldened and empowered Parliament, sort of brought them into the national conversation when he wanted really to stamp authority on his divorces or his succession acts and things like that. So, yeah, looking for the roots of the Civil War, you can see things in James's reign, but you can see things in Elizabeth's reign. I mean, you can see things going right back. James, like Elizabeth, had confrontations with various parliaments, and there was the addled parliament, for example, but he was able to avoid major constitutional conflict. So he would have these celebrated moments, these ripping things out of the parliamentary book and things in a rage. But he knew how to kind of back down, to climb down. Whereas Charles, I think, Charles is interesting in that he didn't know when to back down, but neither did Parliament. So both of them, I mean, that was just a perfect storm, really, of stiff-necked people on both sides. It was always going to lead to some sort of conflict.
So James was probably a little bit cannier in that regard.
James was a cannier king, I think. He knew when to make a sort of dramatic argument. He knew when to make a take advantage of the high drama of the moment to put his foot down, but he knew when to back down as well.
You've briefly mentioned his legacy, I guess, amongst Scottish schoolchildren. But for those in England, he's mentioned as James the First. And unfairly, no one says James, or fewer people say James the
Yes,
Sixth.
James the Sixth and first.
But yeah, how should we look at him really then?
I think it's one thing we don't do, and I have to commend the Mary and George series for this. For years, for centuries, since just after his death, there has been the horrible stereotype about him written by, we think, Anthony Weldon. This is the image of him sort of lurching around, leaning on people, his tongue too big for his mouth, constantly drooling. This bizarre caricature that people accepted for very long. I still see people accepting it. I've seen people criticize the new show for saying, oh, James is far too understandable. In real life, his tongue was too big for his mouth, and that is not true. It's just people have accepted this as part of the kind of myth of James. So I'm actually pleased to see that the series is showing a human figure. I mean, he might be, yes, shown as being obsessed with sex and a bit more unpleasant than the real James was to people in his inner circle, but it's not playing on the stereotypes that I think a lot of people still hold of him, the idea that he was this sort of buffoonish figure.
I mean, even if you look at it from a very high level, to have unified the crowns during a time when, only a few years before he took the crown of England, England and Scotland were at war. So it's an extraordinary achievement. And then for it then to remain unified.
Yeah, I think his real legacy is his success. I think he was a victim of his own success, particularly in England. What he had sought to do was end the Spanish War, the Anglo-Spanish War, which he did, and then maintain peace for as long as possible, which he did until obviously Europe was engulfed in the 30 Years' War. That wasn't his fault. It might have been his daughter and son-in-law's fault, partly, but wasn't his. So if we look at it from that side, he achieved peace. That to modernize is a really laudable thing, that he was pushing for this European peace. That's good. But it might not have looked like that at the time. People were starting to look back and think, remember the Spanish Armada when we saw off Philip's galleons and things? Wasn't that great? So you've got this weird nostalgia for war. And you start to, that's when you start to see Parliament really clamouring for, we want to be militant Protestants. We want to be sending English soldiers over to sort of fight for Protestantism. So James's peace, attractive to us, didn't necessarily look attractive to everyone at the time.
Fascinating stuff. This has been great. So James the First. So the title is James the First, James the Sixth, Wisest Fool.
The wisest fool, yes. The lavish life of James the Sixth and First. That's one thing that I should have pointed out, that the new show shows a very opulent court. Opulent and I suppose extremely dirty, what's going on underneath. But that's right. I mean, James did have this exceptionally colourful, bright, spectacle-filled court, which people don't associate with him. They associate that with Elizabeth. They associate it with Henry VIII, the really kind of glittering court. James's made their courts look like a Sunday school picnics. It was just really lavish.
Amazing, amazing. And the wisest fool, that after what we've just been discussing for 45 odd minutes, that seems a rather unfair description of him.
Yes, this is the famous sobriquet that he was given, again, from the Anthony Weldon text. It's often ascribed to Henry IV of France, but it wasn't actually, he didn't say it. It's been falsely attributed to him. And the claim was that he was the wisest fool in Christendom because he was wise in small matters, but a fool in great matters. When I think if you look at his reign, the opposite was true. He was very wise in the big stuff, the big ticket stuff, European peace, that kind of thing. But in small matters, personal relationships and things, he could, I suppose, a bit of a fool for love.
Great stuff. Well, that's a lovely way to end it. Thank you, Stephen. This has been fantastic. And
Thank
I've
you.
put links in the show notes for listeners to find the wisest fool.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening. I very much enjoyed that. Hope you did too. If you can give me a good rating, that'd be great. But in the meantime, thank you and good night.